This is Armando Nobody with a positive mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm very excited. I've been able to recover an old interview that I did with a dear friend, Marilyn Ferguson, author of The Aquarian Conspiracy. This program has been lost in cassette tape, and we haven't been able to hear it. She is one of the best people I ever met, one of my closest friends. She's now deceased, but this is a wonderful interview for you. So I'll now lead you back in time to Armand DeMille from quite a few years ago.
The Positive Mind, making your brain work better by introducing it to your heart and your soul. The Positive Mind, not just learning how to think better, but integrating thinking and feeling and the spirit of life. Now, as most of you know by now, I've seen the primary cause of human fragmentation as being the split between who we really are and who we think we should be. I see society as fostering this division by nurturing conformity and starving uniqueness. I've been a therapist for 25 years, but I see the primary problem of my profession is its dedication to the conformity of the norm. Psychiatry even has a phrase we use to reward those who conform with ease. We call them normal. Well, my dedication to you on this program is to help you nurture your uniqueness, to help you become as close to your real self as possible, to help you avoid the Prozacian mutation that is proliferating our Gingrichian society. Did I say that? Say it again. Help you avoid the Prozacian mutation that is proliferating our Gingrichian society. And I do that by showing you that we have a right to feel what we feel, think what you think, see what you see, and know what you know. How did I get there in this place where you listen to me and value what I have to say? I did it, as Joe Cocker would say, with a little help from my friends. And I've had some real special friends over my lifetime, many of whom have changed the way things are, who dared to stand up and be counted. Today, I bring you a special and dear friend who has made a difference. She's the author of The Aquarian Conspiracy, a mind-boggling bestseller from the 80s that has become one of the Bibles for human integrity. Marilyn Ferguson is also the originator of The Brain Mind Bulletin, a monthly report on research and science that's really kind of about the brain-mind research, and it comes out every month, and people subscribe to that, and it's fabulous. You want the cutting edge of science that's meaningful, and it comes through in her publication. And is working on a new book that will appear probably next year. I met Marilyn in the late 70s, and for a while we traveled around together doing a series of workshops known as the Power of Knowing? Yeah. Power of Knowing seminars. We had quite a team who were introducing people to parts of themselves that were dormant. And I could spend a whole hour just telling you stories about how this brilliant person, friend, affected this planet. But I'd rather you get to know Marilyn yourself. Marilyn, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks, everyone.
Marilyn, we could spend the hour talking about the Aquarian Conspiracy, but people could buy the book. Okay, so let's assume that all of that is known or could easily be known. I'd love to cover the work and the research that you've been doing recently since the book was published. And as you know, I've been talking about the division between the real self and the narcissistic image self. The title I've used for the series of tapes that I've made and the series of programs I've done on narcissism has been called The Drama of the Gifted Child. And it really talks about the problems which face gifted children when parents kind of celebrate and reward the child for the gifts and they kind of want the child to produce and they live for production. So people don't get a chance to really explore their own gift. What do you think about gifted adults?
Buckminster Fuller said one time, there is no such thing as a genius. Some of us are just less damaged than others. And I think in terms of gifted adults, that it's appropriate for gifted adults to be really humble. Because somewhere along the line, either by nature of the challenges, the combination of challenges and encouragement, they were able to have a certain confidence and be able to express themselves in a certain way, but that we're all secretly gifted and we're all secretly retarded.
So in some way, all of us have our gifts available, and everybody has that available, and mm-hmm. Well, what about talent? Do you think there are more, that the talent makes the difference?
My talent is a dime a dozen,
mm-hmm.
I think. I mean, there's so many Everybody's got some talents, and one of the problems with having talent is a lot of people think that justifies their existence.
Mm-hmm.
And the visionaries that I've been studying over the years and writing about and thinking about are people who have an idea and make it work in the world. And so they're very practical, and because they've tried a lot, they have failed a lot, so they're pretty humble, too.
So, what is a visionary?
Well, we all have a visionary capacity, but some people are using it, so they're what I would call practicing visionaries. And, you know, we all have, somebody pointed out, if we didn't have something like vision, we wouldn't remember where we left the car in the, you know, parking garage or whatever. Vision is the capacity to imagine something that's not there right now. So if you look at if the closet is a mess and you're thinking about cleaning it, you probably have a vision of what it would be like clean.
Mm-hmm.
And that could motivate you to go through the drudgery of cleaning it. And on a bigger scale, it could be that you're Ted Turner and you've decided that there is a place for an all-news television station,
mm-hmm.
network. There's this whole range of vision. And then there's like a big vision, like your maybe life work or a major vision. But you also have to envision all the little steps to bring it about. So the capacity to drop some of your assumptions and like feel your knowledge. You tune into the field and actually, like, there's so much stuff that we're not paying attention to. First of all, we're too visual.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last 150 years, the visual sense has come to dominate because it is in our society. Most of the smells we smell are synthetic.
Mm-hmm.
We don't use our ears as much as we might. I talk about common sense. In fact, I talk about radical common sense. And what common sense originally meant, as it was used both in the English and in the Greek and the Latin it came from, was what is common among our senses. Like, what do our senses know in common, not what's common among people? Because everybody would have a different consensus. So that means we really need to get down to the nitty-gritty of our senses, and we need to be awake. A lot of people would like to make some kind of leap into higher consciousness, but they don't want to have to bother to be looking and listening.
But there are certain people that you've looked at and studied over time, the people who have, who you consider real...
Noticeably
visionaries.
Right.
What are the characteristics of these visionaries? I know you've kind of...
Well, it was funny because I knew that there must be a visionary profile when I started this study and the people did surveys and tests and all this. At the same time, they were all saying, and I knew in my heart of hearts, that anybody has the capacity to be visionary. So for a little while, it seemed like it was a bit of a paradox. But then I realized that the thing that characterized the successful visionaries was not innate ability. It was an attitude and habits. And
for an example, the people you were studying are people like
They could be
Thomas Paine.
There are historical visionaries and there are contemporary visionaries. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned, Ted Turner, let's say Václav Havel would be one.
Mm-hmm.
People who, you know, are successfully writing plays and inventing things and doing business and figuring out better ways to sweep the streets. You know, mm-hmm. It's like it's a whole range of things. And I studied a couple hundred people. Yeah.
Among the historical ones?
Well, I would say, you know, certainly Charles Lindbergh would be a blatant example of somebody who had a vision of what he was going to do. They're basically the achievers. They're the people who, by sheer dint of their passion, like groups of visionaries, like the founding fathers or people in the Renaissance or the people who put together a company could be. They're all around us.
So a visionary is somebody who has an idea mm-hmm. and manifests that idea.
Well, one time I remember thinking, I'd been reading, Abraham Lincoln had been talking about Thomas Jefferson's vision, and Jefferson was his hero. And I thought, Thomas Jefferson's vision, everybody was talking about, what was Thomas Jefferson's vision? And I had an interesting experience. I suddenly saw like a little icon of Thomas Jefferson in my mind, and it was as if I heard a voice. He said, the American dream is about the freedom to dream. Now, we talk about the American dream like it's a materialistic thing, you know, it's like you're ambitious to get rich or something. But that the one thing that the founders, although they disagreed on so many other things, the one thing they agreed about is they were all dissidents and the children of dissidents. And they believed you should have the right to have your own dream. So, I mean, I think that's part of it. And so we're all born with our own idea. When you were 4 years old, you couldn't have been a conformist because you didn't know enough mm-hmm. to be conforming.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of ironic that then we have to go to special courses and seminars and do things to get all this stuff out of our way to get to our gifts.
And what are these the characteristics that you see of these people who you would...
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the characteristics that I noticed was that... This is one I noticed, not one that came out of the tests and the surveys, but I realized at some point that successful visionary people have learned to parent themselves. Like good parents, or like a good coach or a good teacher. We know if we are dealing with children that we want to try to be kind, we want to try to be encouraging, and we don't want to stomp all over them, and we have idea, we know what was done wrong to us. But in dealing with ourselves, we're still pretty nasty.
Mm-hmm.
And so something goes wrong, you go, oh, I should have known, and so on. And these people have learned how to encourage themselves. Not to deny, don't rationalize it away. Regret is a useful emotion. It's a physical emotion that's mm-hmm. got to therefore be there for some evolutionary purpose. When you feel the physical emotion of regret, which I think for me is like in my chest sometimes, it means pay attention. Something that just happened had some kind of problem with it. If you go back and see what it was, then mentally you could rehearse doing things differently and you'd be prepared for the next time. But they don't stay down on themselves.
So putting yourself down, which is what depression is, actually mm-hmm. depressing the self, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. kind of blocks your visionary ability.
You're always looking backward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're feeling like your failures, you identify with your failures. I found in one series of tests that 100 of the people did, that the people who did the test, which is called the Berkman, it's a really marvelous test. It takes like 200-300 questions, and while you're doing it, you think, what am I doing? This is really stupid, but it's a brilliant test. And they were able to compare for me the profiles of the visionaries with people who take this normally in the workplace. And what they said was that the visionary people tended to be high in a trait they called authority, which means like the ability to take charge in, in a group, to exert leadership, but low on a trait they called advantage, which meant they were not necessarily looking for personal advantage. In fact, they were more inclined to be interested in the advantage of the group.
So they're more authoritative. They may be leaders, mm-hmm. but not leaders for the sake of power.
Right. Not mm-hmm. not for personal power or advantage. They tended to be high-energy people, but they were not necessarily, in that particular test, what's called low structure, which means rebelling against structure. Because a lot of high-energy people are rebels.
Right. A lot of high-energy people are kind of running all the time. Somebody's mm-hmm. driving the car.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're a loose cannon.
Right. You're a loose cannon. But they tended to not be lacking in structure.
They could live with structure. They could work through structure. Then there's a test that Ned Herman did, or it's an instrument that has to do with left and right brain function and front and back. And he told me that at one point, he said, well, the first 29 of the first 30 you sent me were all in the same quadrant, the same part of the thing, and they were intuitive, holistic. And it didn't matter whether they were scientists or business people or artists or psychotherapists or what. And they tended to fit a profile he had found before when he did a study of the most unusual person I know. He had a lot of people recommend them. And so I think what it is the more you become yourself, which is a lot what I gather you're talking about here, the more you become yourself, the more you may appear to be a bit eccentric or unusual to other people. Because, as my friend Jean Houston said one time, there's no such thing as a normal person. They're just people you don't know very well.
Yeah.
One of the things I found in my research is that I began cataloging all the fears that we have. You know, fears of death, fears of life, fear of failure, fear of success. And there's a fear of being strange. You know, most people are going around secretly thinking, God, if only people only knew that I'm not grown up or that I'm really weird.
What's that child's expression? I would fly...
Oh, from the Aquarian Conspiracy, she would fly as long as if everybody else did, otherwise it would be too embarrassing.
Too conspicuous.
Too conspicuous, yeah.
Right.
This
is Armand DeMille mm-hmm. with you with The Positive Mind, doing the unusual, bringing you a friend, a guest, Marilyn Ferguson, an important mind, an important person here, who's been doing quite a bit to make this world a little better planet to live in. Her books have been translated into how many languages, Marilyn?
I think about 12.
12 different languages, mm-hmm. And it's been around, and it's affected quite a few people directly. And there's another book forthcoming, as well as this publication, The Brain Mind Bulletin. The visionary person, I mean, everybody who... Wait, let me take a step back. I remember you had a party. We had a gathering, the Academy of Mad Scientists, right? Mm-hmm. How many people were there?
It was the Mad Scientists and Artists Party, yeah. Actually. It was in the Academy. It was another one of our wacky things we did. There were about 80 people there. Gene Roddenberry was there, and Tom Robbins, and the scientist Carl Pribram, and Arthur Young. It was a great party, wasn't it?
It was a great party. It was a great party, and they all got together, and mostly they were relaxed. Uh-huh. Mostly they were relaxed. Mostly it was not, I'm going to impress you with who I am and what I know. And I noticed that the one thing I noticed about the people who were what I consider to be visionaries is they were comfortable with themselves.
Yeah,
not because of fame. Mm-hmm. Not because of fame, but because they were comfortable with their minds. They appreciated their gift, their mm-hmm. ability to do something. Mm-hmm. And they all went to MSU, didn't they?
MSU
is the university that Marilyn Ferguson developed. What's it? What does MSU stand for?
Making stuff up.
And making stuff up. What is making stuff up important for?
Well, as my husband said to me, what is creativity? And he knew, I guess, but he'd asked it on a whim, and I said, making stuff up. And he said, making stuff up. MSU, the new institution of higher learning. And so when I started talking about it in seminars, I said, look around you. You know, I mean, look at the carpet and look at the walls and look at the architecture and the cars and look at your hairstyle and everything. Somebody made it up. Somebody made up everything. Why not you? Why not me? That just we have to have the sense, I think, of participation instead of being the consumers, the passive consumers of our culture.
A lot of people believe that the way they become the most aware is to go through the meditative state, right? And they meditate and they meditate and they expand their awareness. Is that the awareness that you think leads to a visionary?
I think meditation is a great tool.
Mm-hmm.
As sometimes they point out in terms of meditation instruction, it's not just the time you spend meditating, which could be 20 minutes or whatever. It's the time before and the time afterward.
Mm-hmm.
And one Indian teacher said it's like when you're dyeing a fabric and you take it out and you hang it in the sun for a while before you dye it some more. I found back in the early 70s when I started meditating that it made my senses more acute. I would come out of meditation and remember the pink flowers were pinker, and I became aware. I'll tell you what was interesting, Armand. I became aware of how much I was repressing. I would be reading a story in the newspaper about some tragic event, and I would find myself in tears. And I realized that it must have been going on before, but I would squelch it. So I was glad. I mean, it was good to be feeling more and seeing more.
What's the danger of the meditation?
Oh, it was the only thing. People get hung up on it. They think that it is the be-all and end-all, and instead of seeing it as a tool. One of the things I am interested in right now is something I've come to call the cult of numbers. The definition of a cult usually has to do with they place a person or an idea at kind of the top of the pyramid and they worship it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that in our society, we have been brainwashed into a cult. It's been going on so long that most of us were born into it. And that we worship numbers. Numbers like meditation or psychedelics or anything else should be tools. They're not the thing to worship. So we have polls and ratings and the Fortune 500 and annual income and gross national product. And we want to know who was first and who was last and how many medals.
Right? And numbered chakras.
How many chakras, right? What is the bottom line? And, I mean, you look at our language after a while, and you realize that we have gotten lost in a sea of quantities.
Mm-hmm.
And so the things that really matter to us got lost in all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people, haven't you wondered about those people who have $200 million and they want $300 million? I mean, there's no way they've got time to spend it all, right? But it's a game. It's numbers. They want to be able to go down in history as, like, the biggest income for a CEO or whatever that is. And yet, there's not a lot of happiness to be found in numbers, per se. I mean, there's the kind of the thrill of the moments winning. There's a very, very major politician I know, and I won't name him, who was telling me the story about how he had always been a high achiever, and he would pull something off and he would be getting a lot of applause, but it felt empty. And then he pulled something off with a group of people. It was a bipartisan group, and they did something that was of international significance. And he said that it was so rewarding, you know, that to be in something that was collaborative like that. That, but as I was telling you that a minute ago, I just pictured that emptiness that comes. There's a moment's thrill, and then it's like, so what?
Well, you see, the thing I see among the people who I consider to be the visionaries is they have a sense of excitement about them. There's an energy about them. There's something that seems to be exuding from them. It's not necessarily a nervous energy, but it's a life energy. Mm-hmm. And then you combine that with a meditative mind, with a meditative ability. Sometimes I see people meditating themselves into a numbness, into a relaxed state, where they get so relaxed that their mind stops creating. Mm-hmm. Isn't there a part of our chemistry that's essential for keeping our creative mind? I mean, if you just think about adrenaline alone.
Well, there was, as has been pointed out in the last couple of years, for a time there was maybe an overemphasis on relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
Because relaxation itself is not necessarily all rewarding. I think we need to go in and out. People, I think it's the baboons, or the leaders, have a more responsive adrenaline system.
Mm-hmm.
So if a crisis comes up, their adrenaline shoots up quicker than the other baboons. And when it's over, it comes down faster. I think that that maybe the danger in there has to do with people avoiding stress. When, in fact, if you avoid stress, you're never going to be able to be in the game. What we need to do is the more, I mean, I've just gone through a very, very challenging part of my life, and I think that you have too, and it's, you're after a while, your brain and your body go, I guess this is how it's going to be, and they get very efficient at dealing with the next crisis.
Yeah, so it's...
And then you have a kind of an amused attitude about your crises. It's just another one.
Just another crisis coming. So it's not the avoidance of crisis. It's taking it on. And having the adversity is what helps develop the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen specifically, you know, people who have a hardship that they have to face, and they take it on.
Mm-hmm.
And they take it on. I knew someone who was with someone who was very sick recently. And when asking him, how are things going? He says, I'm taking it on. You know, I'm facing it. I'm in it. It's not a happy time. I'm very unhappy because I have to keep tending to this illness. But I'm doing it. I'm committed to it. And that develops the spirit.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know,
Hermann Hesse said, I think the way out is the way through.
Mm-hmm. The way out is the way through. Well, among the people that that you've helped foster and study, you know quite a few people. Among the people that you've helped bring around, you've seen a few people who come up with some creative idea that's really different. And I guess what you appreciate and what I appreciate and what most of my friends appreciate is someone who does something a little differently. It's just different. I met a young man recently who's, every time he comes up with an idea, his father says, ah, it's just another wacky idea. And saying that to the kid kind of squelches the child's development of his mind. If it's an unusual idea, it's worth listening to. You know, if someone has the unusual, if they've created something, if something comes out of nowhere,
mm-hmm.
we're seeing the essence of genius or the essence of that.
You know the expression, it occurred to me? You
mm-hmm.
could say, it occurred to me. That's a flag. When something occurs to you out of nowhere, pay attention. Because I think that's a lot of people think that they are not tuned in or psychic or whatever because they don't pay attention. If it occurs to you to call somebody, call them. Particularly if there's no reasonable reason to do it. And I think that, now the thing that you said about what we really admire is the original, the unique, the person who's willing to be herself, himself. But also that they don't turn that into a shtick.
Mm-hmm.
that one, just because you got something and now everybody thinks it's really neat and they like it and everything, to not become infatuated with your own personality.
No, because you get stuck in it. I remember when I was working with the multiple personalities and one of the, and I had this idea that was not in any of the psychiatric literature, that what we needed was a marriage. We needed an actual ceremony of the selves. We needed, instead of trying to segment them and put them off at distances, we needed them to get married and we needed a ceremony. And I was going to do a treatment with a patient where I was going to create a ceremony of marriage. And it was just a dream, just an idea. And when I did, when I discussed it with a psychiatrist, I know he said, well, that's wacky, you can't do that, blah, 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 blah. And I kept the thought, I kept the thought, I kept the thought, until finally I did that with one patient, and it was the cure. And it worked. And other people have picked up that model of creating that as a cure for multiple personality dysfunction.
So, I mean, brain research is not just something that's a kind of a laboratory thing, and what's really interesting about it is the fact that it's a way of understanding the phenomenon of holophonic sound. It's a way of knowing that our intelligence isn't limited because our brains keep changing forever, and so on.
The brain research itself, you know, is kind of fascinating. And I know that I've always enjoyed the brain-mind bulletin, you know, but I figured since we're mentioning it here, let's talk a bit about it. What do you do with that?
What? Well, I wrote a book called The Brain Revolution. It came out in 1973. I was actually a poet and a mystic, and I only wandered into this stuff because I was interested in my mystical experiences. I had also started meditating, and I had these tiny children, and I realized I'd begun to get onto the fact that there was some brain research to show that, as I suspected, intelligence was not something that you came into the cradle with in terms of a score and a limit, but something that was dynamic and ever-changing. So I wrote, in the course of writing The Brain Revolution, it took a couple of years to do the research, I realized that nobody was staying on top of the news. I mean, it would be go into some journal, it would take 5 years to come out. So kind of reluctantly, I decided that somebody had to do it. I had to do some kind of a news thing about consciousness and learning and creativity and dreams and parapsychology and so on. So in 1975, so it's almost 20 years ago, this fall, I started publishing The Bulletin.
And the bulletin covers what seems to be
whatever fascinates us at the moment.
Whatever you're getting a kick out of at the moment. Now, I find it fascinating. I've used some of the stuff for the shows. How do people subscribe to the Brainwind Bulletin?
Well, they can write to us at Box 42211, Los Angeles, 90042. We're also in the Los Angeles directory. It's the 213 area code. They can call 800-553-MIND, and subscriptions are $45 a year. They can also inquire about the holophonic sound, because finally, after all these years, we have a digital cassette that the inventor has delivered to us. And so I just, you know, I like to bring things to people the way I would do it to my friends. It was like, this is the this is the print version of the Mad Scientist and Artist Party.
I understand. The so people could, if people keep in touch with information, right, that could help them develop their mind. But developing the self, there's a lot of obstacles to developing the self. A lot of things you've got to look for. You've got to look for this thing about validation, right? I think you, the need for validation, who was it? Jose Arguelles?
Jose Arguelles said, the need for validation is the last obstacle to self-empowerment.
I haven't seen him for years.
I heard he's in Mexico.
He's in Mexico?
We should say that again so people can, because I found that such a powerful thing. The need for validation is the last obstacle to self-empowerment. I mean, we want somebody to tell us it's okay.
Uh-huh. And if they don't tell us it's okay,
maybe we can't do it.
We lose our thought. Well, that's what we covered in the drama of The Gifted Child. It's all that most people are performing or using their skills or their mind to get the approval, love, and affection. And I think that's where the trap is. That's the difference between the visionary and the gifted person, or the person who's got the talent. This is Armand DeMille. You've been listening to an interview I did a while back with my good friend Marilyn Ferguson. This was done in the late 90s with the help of my cousin and engineer, Julian Gioiello. We have worked at bringing you this archive. Marilyn was a true visionary. She died a few years ago, but left a legacy of commitment to intellectual integrity. I've chosen a selection of music for you dedicated to Marilyn and her work
with her book, The Aquarian Conspiracy.
WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial.
Hi, this is Julian Joiello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm 20 years old, and I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website, WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
This is Armando Mill back with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you my friend Marilyn Ferguson, now deceased, who helped me and countless others appreciate the uniqueness of our creative minds. Because the visionary doesn't really look for the validation. The visionary knows.
Finally learns, I think. I remember there was a point a couple of years ago. I was visiting Ireland at the time. My little granddaughter had just been born. And I was sitting over there. I was going through some personal anguish because a friend with quotes around it, it was just like really after me. I mean, somebody I knew was really saying a lot of poisonous stuff about me, so much stuff that I didn't even know, I couldn't even counter because I didn't know what it was. And I was feeling sorry for myself, and all of a sudden I thought about the people who really have become public figures, like a Ted Turner or a Jane Fonda or somebody who is really in the public eye, who is attacked all the time. And I realized that they must have just learned to not care. And that it's ridiculous to worry about what people are going to be saying about you, because there will always be something. I mean, there is stuff that is misunderstood. There is stuff that is out of context. There's stuff that's true, not true. I mean, it doesn't really matter. We just have to be who we are, because it's too much work to be anybody else.
Mm-hmm. And those who spend all their time covering themselves wind up being covered people who come out, and you can see that they're protected, you know, they're careful. I had a
like charm is one.
Yeah, I had a physician on the show once who I was asking an opinion, and he refused to make any statement unless he wrote it down first and ran it through his legal brain. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make sure he couldn't get sued for what he was saying, so so he wrote down everything he was about to say. If I asked him a question, he'd have to wait 3 minutes so that he could write out his response.
Uh-huh.
And then evaluate. Can I get sued for this? And then give me the response. Mm-hmm. What about attention, Marilyn? I mean, developing the ability to attend, I think, is the first great teacher, the beginning step, mm-hmm. learning to attend.
And it's hard. I mean, if you try to pay attention to in a kind of focused way for a minute, it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
I think things like attention and memory are things we think should be easy, and they're not. They're challenging. But that attention, to me, attention is the key. I think it was somebody said, supposedly, this is probably not a true story, it's probably apocryphal, but somebody asked Buddha what were the three most important things, and he said attention, attention, and attention. If we learn to notice what's going on, it doesn't mean, like when we say pay attention, it's like in a very intense way, it causes children to become myopic in school and so on. It's the more relaxed attention. I think this is where relaxation comes in. Remember, Armand, when biofeedback was first an important thing, they talked about the state of relaxed alertness.
Mm-hmm.
It was a kind of paradox, but that we're relaxed enough that our peripheral vision is functioning, and we're able to take things in a general kind of way. John Briggs, who wrote Fire in the Crucible, made up a word he calls omnivalence. And it's a way of getting, like, if you can get still enough and you let everything have equal value, then what's important will come up and hit you in the head. But because we have an agenda all the time, we're laying a trip on our experience.
So trying to paying attention, really...
being attention might be
Being attention
word.
Is a better mm-hmm. word. Mm-hmm. Where does attention come from? Attendre? What's the origin of attention?
Attendere, to stretch.
To stretch, means to stretch.
to yeah.
Means to be able to see. Now, one of the things that I know about the people who are making a difference is that they spot everything.
Mm-hmm.
They're not paranoid, but if something kind of passes through their vision, it isn't unnoticed. Everything mm-hmm. is kind of noticed, yet they don't spend too much time on any one thing because they might not be noticing something.
Right, they might say to you later, right, they might say to you later, did you notice how disturbed that woman was in the grocery store? Because so forth. So they don't make a big production of it.
They caught it. They don't judge it. They don't do anything with it, but they catch what's going on.
Oh, that's an important thing you just said. If we quit thinking, like, that we have to figure out everything that's right and wrong, we would have more energy for our attention. But we think we have to say, I like this, I don't like this.
And that's the problem. It gets in the way. The judgment gets in the way. It is, rather than, is it good or is it bad? It is. So developing a talent, is there any way of developing intelligence?
Well, intelligence just means, I mean, going back to the original words, by the way, I was wrong about attention. Pretend means to stretch. Tendere is the same thing. I'm not sure exactly what attention is. Intelligence comes from intelligere, which means to collect or to gather. If we quit thinking about intelligence as IQ scores, I mean, it's ridiculous because it isn't an IQ score. Intelligence is just gathering information, just like in the intelligence services, which is actually the way it was more often used. British intelligence, you know, he's an intelligence agent. It's the gathering of information. And that if we realize that it's a choice to be intelligent, that being intelligent is a consequence of what we were talking about of awareness. It's not cleverness. It's like, that's what's gotten us into so much trouble, is all this cleverness without awareness.
This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. My guest, Marilyn Ferguson, author of a few things. Author of the Aquarian Conspiracy and Pragmatics and the Aquarian Conspiracy and the Brain Mind Bulletin, which is currently available. And now upcoming a new book that we can't mention yet, but should be around
next
year.
Well, we can mention it. We just can't talk about it too much.
Okay, we can mention it, but we can't talk about it. What is it? Let's talk about it a little bit. Because
we can talk about it. We can't.
Because the contract isn't out there yet.
Right.
Here, first on WBAI, as usual, the beginning, the first information. Here it comes. Come on, Marilyn, what's the new book about?
Radical Common Sense, Secrets of the Visionary Life, is the book I've been putting together for a number of years. And it will come out next year, we can say that much. And it's the how that the Aquarian Conspiracy was the what and the who of. The Aquarian Conspiracy told about the networks of people who had gone through personal changes and who'd found each other and were working to bring about a more humane society. It was kind of about an open conspiracy. And one of the things that I have found over the years, having met a great many of the people who had read the book and who used it one way or another, was that everybody was still looking for more clues and tips on how to make things work. It's not easy to make a more creative, workable society because of all the things about ourselves, you know, and all of our history. And so there needed to be more of a how. And so it seemed to me the smartest thing would be to find out the secrets of all the people who've done the impossible. Let's pool them. And, I mean, nobody is a bigger customer for wanting this information than the people who are already visionary.
So that's what you put together, or you... Listen, you mentioned something a little earlier that I'm curious about. You said you were at one point a housewife with a couple of children deciding to pull together information, and it was your first writing attempt?
That's not quite accurate. I've been writing since I was a little kid. And I wrote a book that most people would not think to associate with these later books called Champagne Living on a Beer Budget. That was published, it was on How to Live Well on a Modest Income. It was published in 1968. And my husband at that time was a newspaper man, and newspaper people don't have any money. So we were really very kind of creative about what we did. And this was back when people weren't talking about things like garage sales and consumer things and knowing how to buy Brand X and a lot of these sort of tricks. But I had been a poet and a fiction writer before I got into nonfiction. I was a stringer for what they call Stringer for Time magazine. I wrote political speeches. I wrote radio commercials when I was 17. But what had happened was, and I was writing a lot of, I wrote television treatments. I wrote continuity for radio shows. But I was a mother with small children, and I got drawn into the science because there were the answers to a lot of things. And it was so romantic. It was far more romantic than writing fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really went back to fiction because the truth was so strange.
When you wrote The Aquarian Conspiracy, you got an unusual response. Did you really think that The Aquarian Conspiracy was going to get the response that it did? Did you think that when it came out, it was really going to be the hit that it was?
I thought it should be.
You thought it should be?
Yeah, but it was, half of my mind thought, this is going to blow their socks off. And the other half of my mind, as a writer, said, forget it. Don't get your hopes up. You know what it's like. The publisher won't have books in the right places at the right time. It isn't going to work. I was amazed, I must say. I didn't allow myself to think too far. So when I would hear from people in a village in South Africa or meet famous people who told me that their work that I admired had been inspired by the Aquarian Conspiracy, that blew my mind.
Who were some of the people who said that they had been deeply affected?
I feel embarrassed to say.
Uh-huh.
I guess. Well,
you write their names down and I'll say it.
Well, actually,
no, there have been quite a few. I know I've met a few through you, but there are people who were surprised and have been
turned
around.
Well, there were people. Let me say without saying who, because it feels like this is a personal kind of thing. You know, like I would see a movie and I would go, "Oh my God, do I love that movie? Do I want to meet the director?" And then the director would say, "I was going to commit suicide, and then I read your book, and I didn't do it."
It went as far as the royal family to as far as leaders in the Far East and that, and Indian folks and a lot.
It's been a thrill. I mean, there's a line once that I read about to be the hero of your heroes. You know, like there is nothing more thrilling than that. So it gets to be this kind of mutual admiration thing. But I think what it is, this is partly, I guess, why I'm so fascinated with the whole creative process, is that we do feed each other. The Aquarian Conspiracy, when that book was in manuscript or galleys, I forget which, I got a call from one of the people whose work I wrote about. He was at an airport somewhere and he'd just seen it, been reading it. He said, "This isn't your book, this is our book."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Ken, that's exactly what I felt. This book that I'm working on now, I've worked on years, the people who've helped us, the research, the scut work of the research, the people who participated, and all the lives I'm drawing from, I feel really like it's my privilege to be able to do this."
I understand, and I understand your reluctance to mention the names of people because it sounds like name dropping or stuff like that, but
yeah.
I think it's kind of a thrill.
Uh-huh.
I think it was kind of a thrill. I know, for example, a couple of corporations taking a look at the Aquarian Conspiracy, which is about kind of discuss how you could do even business a little different,
mm-hmm.
right? I think it was Struthers Scientific was one of the few corporations that picked it up and said, let's remodel what we're doing based on what we see here.
Well, business people, to my surprise, were the most actively responsive group after the book came out. And I think it's because they're very practical. So they're interested in anything that works, which is why they tend to respond to new seminars, trainings, concepts. Because I have learned over the years, and there's no greater spiritual discipline than being in business. And I think that the reason I used to think that we had a very sick society because we had so much admiration for business, but just in terms of the sheer survival, trying to stay on top of things, to know what people want, and to be able to respond and to change is a really important training. But we need to be open-minded enough to be able to see there are some visionaries whose visions I do not like, including people who have been my proclaimed enemies, who've actually set out to undermine my work that I thought about including in this study, because they definitely are effective. You know, I mean, they were able to have an idea, write books about it, and, you know, I...
So you can admire the talent of somebody who, even if they destroy you...
Well, right.
Well done.
The people who decided that they wanted to destroy parapsychology, the so-called psychops, I mean, I don't like what they did, and I don't think they play fair, but in a way, it was a vision.
Mm-hmm.
But what I chose to do is, for the people that I'm exploring, really studying, they're people that I consider to be more open-minded and creative and collaborative.
Mm-hmm. And of the folks out there, do you think that there are people still taking risks, or do you think that the environment...
Jack Kemp is a visionary, too.
Do you think that the environment is such that people are getting more afraid because of the more conservative society?
Well, you know, I think that we're going through a period a bit like... There is an aspect of it that's like the McCarthy era.
Mm-hmm.
In which, I mean, the very idea that the word liberal became a dirty word is ridiculous. It was Dwight Eisenhower who said we should all be liberal, we should all be conservative. People had better not be getting afraid, you know, because that's how we lose it. There's somebody was saying to me the other night, a well-known writer, actor in New York, was saying that people are terrified to talk about their experiences with mind-altering substances, mm-hmm. and so they frequently can't tell. Business people do it to get their ideas. I mean, a lot of people do it. They can't. And I said, it's like the McCarthy thing. So, you know, you're going to be accused of being a communist or something like that. And I think that when I wrote The Aquarian Conspiracy, I decided that I needed to be careful and not come on too Christian because that was my background. Well, it turned out that I had a real backlash from not having done that by fundamentalists who thought that I was trying to promote Buddhism in the West or something like that. It was like, you really have to have the courage of your convictions and then find a way to communicate them in a kind way.
So it's almost, there's almost a point if you're trying to develop your own thing and put yourself out there where you've got to, I think you're saying you have to embrace your enemy. Mm-hmm. You have to look at your opponents and mm-hmm. respect them and not get angry. I mean, your investment, mm-hmm. where we go off is when we get mad at them for opposing us.
Right. And you're bound to get mad for a minute. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like after you blow off steam for a while, then you have to stop and think, okay, why did this particular election go that way? Or why is this book popular? There were people who were very critical of the Celestine Prophecy. Mm-hmm. I say you have to look at any book that's selling 100,000 copies a week and see what is it that people are looking for. I mean, there was something very important in there.
Mm-hmm. This is Armand DeMille with you with Marilyn Ferguson. We have a few minutes to go further here, Marilyn. If people were to be looking at themselves now and see that they're either going to stick with their art or not stick with their art, I mean, that's a big question that a lot of people have. I think that the artist is a very important development. How do you perceive the artist as the visionary?
Well, of all of I'm discussing in this book a lot of what I think are very valuable, precious ways of functioning that some people might call archetypes. Not one archetype per person, but all the sub-selves as archetypes. But in a way, I think the master archetype is the artist. That if we all look at what we're doing as the art of our lives, and that if it's the art of medicine or the art of the deal or the art of painting or whatever, that it is a transcendent vision. I remember at one point a few years ago, I'd been giving a lot of lectures in Fresno, California. It was like for 2 days in a row, they had me speaking to every group, colleges and city council members, everybody. And this one evening, I just kind of collapsed in the hotel room. And notice it was a really beautiful room. They had put my husband and me in a very nice suite, and there was a lot of Oriental art objects. And I was sitting on the floor holding them, and I suddenly was feeling like, well, this was my other self. This was my, my artist self. And I'd been being really, kind of businesslike. And I suddenly, it was like I was a character in an Anna Eastman story. She led two lives. And then all of a sudden, I realized that I had buried the poet. I had buried the artist in me. When I was a young person, I knew what I was doing, and I knew that if you're in your life as an artist, you were going to do what you had to do. And somewhere along the line, the cost of my relative success, such as it was it people start saying, do you know you're a spiritual leader, you're this, you're that, well, you can't do this, you can't take these chances, you've got a payroll to meet, and I was like, oh. You know, stop already, forget it, go back.
These are people who had a small vision. There's a story about a woman. How did My Fair Lady get started?
Pygmalion?
Yeah, who wrote that?
It was George Bernard Shaw.
Uh-huh. And it all came from a story that was somebody's idea?
Well, I don't know where his original story was. It was a play, and I saw it once as a play. It's a wonderful story. Oh, but the original Pygmalion, yeah. The original myth or the legend was Greek.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, about the man who wanted his sculpture to come to life.
So you've been listening to Marilyn Ferguson, who's now deceased. Right? This was one of my old friends, and a powerful interview with a very powerful person. And something you've never heard before, so I thought you would appreciate it. If you want to get a copy of it, of course, if you could always listen to it on the archives, thepositivemind.com. And do send me an email. I'd like to hear your response to having heard Marilyn and what she has to say. Bye-bye for now, my friends. Hey there. Friends, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Having been a little under the weather, as we all have, huh? Well, help us with our recovery. Go to WBAI.org and help us by joining the buddy system. The more people we have on a recurrent basis giving money to the station, the less we'll have to have fund drives. Help us cut down on those, and we'll do what we can for you. WBAI.org. Buddy. Make a difference.
Tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio, WBAI, in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Good afternoon. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide.
An intern here at WBAI. If you're listening to this right now, it's evident that you appreciate a wide variety of cultured programming. From news to health to art, WBAI has it all. And now more than ever, we need your support to help WBAI recover from the devastating effects of Hurricane Sandy. You can do this by participating in our holiday drive beginning December 5th and ending on December 15th. Phone lines are temporarily down, but for more information on how to donate, email gm@wbai.org or kdavis@wbai.com or just log on to wbai.org. Your support is greatly appreciated.
My name's Chris Hedges. I'm the author with the cartoonist Joe Sacco of Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And when Joe and I are in New York, we always listen to WBAI 99.5 or WBAI.org because we want to stay informed and not get fed the commercial lies of the corporate media.
Thank you very much, Chris Hedges. Once again, you're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. I'm Michael G.